Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Bloody Joe by Peter Brandvold, narrated by J. Rodney Turner. Chapter 1. Bloody Joe Mannion, town marshal of Del Norte in the southern Colorado Territory, saw the glint of sunlight off steel and eye blink before he threw himself off Red's back. He hit the ground way too hard for a man of 46 years, none of them easy, and rolled instinctively to his left, toward an arroyo, as two bullets tore up rocks and sage just behind him. The hammering reports of two rifles reached his ears above Red's shrill, indignant whinnies and drumming hooves, as the lawman, who also had a deputy county sheriff's commission, dropped over the lip of the arroyo and rolled down the 4-foot embankment. As he rolled, he glanced up to see another bullet pink a rock at the arroyo's lip. The rock smacked Mannion's chest, adding insult to injury, as he came to rest at the base of the cut bank. He ground his jaws in fury. "I'm getting too damn old for this crap." Not bothering to take stock of his condition, fury overwhelming him and dropping a bright red veil down over his eyes, Mannion hated bushwhackers as much as backshooters, card sharps, sky pilots, harpy women, and snake oil drummers. He heaved himself to his knees, set his hat on his head, grabbed both nickel-plated ivory-handled Russian 44s residing in soft leather holsters, and clambered up the embankment. Joe Mannion was a big, broad-shouldered, sun-seared man who emoted in great strength and toughness and a fair amount of wildness, for wild was the land he was from, right here in the Colorado Territory. Mannion's face was flat-planed and hard-lined, ever so vaguely Indian. His mother had been one-quarter Navajo and raised on one of the first ranches in the foothills of the Sawatch, along the Arkansas River. His father, long dead, had been a mountain man. Mannion's skin was ruddy, his eyes the deep cobalt of a mountain lake just after sunset. When angry, they blazed in sun-seasoned sockets. He had a thick head of wavy silver hair stitched with some remaining dark brown. It hung down well past his collar from beneath his high-crowned, broad-brimmed black Stetson. A long, thick gray mustache mantled his broad mouth. On Mannion's 6'4", 220-pound frame, not a pound of it tallow, he wore a brown corduroy shirt, red neck-knotted bandana, black denim pants, wide black belt with a brass buckle, and well-worn black boots. He was breathing hard, cursing under his breath, spitting dirt from his lips. Two more bullets tossed more rocks and gravel and a sage branch into the arroyo. The bullets were followed by the hiccuping reports of both rifles. The echoes of said reports hadn't died before Mannion lifted his head and both hog legs over the top of the cut, aimed quickly, narrowing his fierce blue eyes, and fired into two large sycamores standing on each side of the old Indian trail he'd been following, tracking cattle rustlers. He'd found them all right. The bushwhacker on the left, resembling a large, ungainly bird perched on a branch roughly halfway up the tree, gave a howl and threw away his rifle as Mannion's bullet punched him back sharply. He gave another howl as he lost his perch and toppled off the far side of the branch, turning two backward somersaults and losing his cream hat before landing with a resolute thud at the base of the tree. The second bushwhacker, in the tree on the opposite side of the trail from the first gutless tin horn, grimaced and clutched his left gloved hand to his upper left thigh as he fired his Winchester straight out before him over Mannion's head. The lawman cocked the big Russian in his right hand, aimed again quickly, but more carefully this time. The hogleg bucked, roaring. Mannion watched in satisfaction as the .44-caliber slug painted a purple welt in the dead center of the second spineless Dry Gulcher's forehead, just beneath the brim of his low-crowned, flat-brimmed black hat. The slug sent him the way of the first man, tumbling down, down, ricocheting off a lower branch with a crunching thud, then continuing down, down, before striking the ground with another resolute thud. He lay belly down, arms thrown out to both sides, the blown-out back of his head resembling a pound of fleshy ground beef glistening in the mid-afternoon sunshine, raining down on this forbidding canyon in the remote reaches of the Sawatch Range, formerly a playground of death for the Ute Indians, and whom Mannion had fought with some renown when he'd been stationed at nearby Fort Winslow. But these days, he rarely fought the mostly cowed Utes. Now it was mostly bank, train, and stagecoach robbers, as well as the occasional rustling, dry-gulching sons of bitches like the two that lay before him. Frank Colvin's men. Local rustlers. The rest were likely holed up at the abandoned Scully Ranch, farther up the trail in Bitterwater Canyon. Mannion gave a ragged sigh, tramped back down into the arroyo to retrieve his Stetson. He reshaped it, dusted it off, set it on his head, and climbed up out of the arroyo. He paused to take stock of the two men before him, one on each side of the trail. Only one was moving, the one on the trail's left side. Mannion looked around for his horse, saw the handsome bay stallion standing off in some cedars to his left, reins dangling, looking guardedly back toward the scene of the lead swap, skeptically twitching his ears. "It's all right, Brent," Mannion said. "I've defanged these two servants." He gave a grunt and started forward. He tramped, spurs chinging, toward the Dry Gulcher lying on his back and breathing hard on the left side of the trail, 10 feet away from Mannion now and drawing closer with each stride of the lawman's long legs. He stopped and gazed down at the man before him. Tall, lean, and sandy-haired, with a long beak of a hooked nose, mud-brown eyes, and long, loosely braided mare's tail mustaches. Mannion recognized him as a small-time outlaw named Gaylord Kimball. That sounded about right. Frank Colvin ran only with the lowliest of small-time, long-looping outlaws. Kimball was one of those, for sure. Had been, rather. He wasn't long for this world. Mannion prodded the man's side with the toe of his left boot. "Colvin at the Lion Shack." Frothy blood oozed from the hole in the dying man's blue work shirt and brown leather vest. He grimaced as his stomach expanded and contracted quickly. His eyes had a glassy sheen. He'd hit his head hard, likely cracked his skull, scrambled his marbles, though Mannion had heard they'd been born scrambled. Kimball lifted his head up off the ground and glared at the lawman. "You go to hell, Mannion, you bloody bastard. You killed me and you're twice as old as me. It should have been you." If the ambush had been successful, they'd likely be dumping the big lawman in a deep ravine about now, or into the shaft of an abandoned mine. Plenty of both out here in this rugged country. Most likely, Mannion would never have been seen or heard from again. He thought of Vanjie and winced. That was the problem with being a lawman father. The danger was not only to you, but to those you left behind. He was all Vanjie, short for Evangeline, had. She was all he had. Her mother, Sarah, was dead. Speaking of never being seen or heard from again. Many would cheer his demise, however. Mannion was an uncompromising SOB. He'd admit that up front. You had to be an ornery SOB in his line of work and in this rugged country. Yeah, he'd made enemies. More than friends, in fact. That was all right with Mannion. He'd never had much time for friends, excepting his two deputies, whom he supposed he could call friends, Rio Waits and String Bean McAllister. Mannion grinned coldly down at the dying man. Ah, the fates do have fun, don't they, Kimball? You keep riding. Kimball patted his head to indicate up trail and smiled coldly. Death's waiting for you in Bitterwater Canyon, you old devil. Some said Colvin was fast with a six-shooter. He was also slippery. That's why he'd never actually been caught rustling and given a necktie party. Not yet. But if he was in Bitterwater Canyon, and he was rustling red feather beef as had been reported, his trail would end there. I see you in hell, then. Mannion aimed his left hand, rushing down at a slant, and narrowed his left eye. No, wait! Kimball cried, both eyes cast in sudden horror. The Russian bucked and roared. Kimball broke wind and lay still, his lips still stretched back from his yellow teeth in a grimace. He had a puckered purple hole in his forehead to match the one his friend had received from Mannion's other Russian. The lawman replaced the spent rounds in both pistols with fresh from his cartridge belt, holstered the guns, snapped the keeper thongs in place over the hammers, and walked over to where the second bushwhacker lay on the other side of the trail. He kicked the man onto his back. Eyes glassy in death gazed sightlessly up at Mannion. L.J. Hawkins, Mannion mused aloud. That left Colvin and his three brothers, James, Lute, and Grayson. Mannion probably should have taken one of his two deputies along for this ride, but they were needed to keep the lid on the still-growing Del Norte. This was a no-help kind of country. Mannion pulled off a glove, stuck two fingers in his mouth, and whistled. Presently, Wren came trotting up, reins bouncing along the ground, high-stepping, tail arched, friskily shaking his head. I tell you, boy, Mannion said, taking the reins and swinging up into the leather, this little ride of ours just got a whole lot more adventurous. He patted his prized bay's left wither. But we need a little adventure in our lives now and then, don't we, fella? You know we'd just be bored otherwise. As if in Mannion's 5 years as Del Norte town marshal, he'd ever been born. He'd been brought in originally to tame the town, for he'd been renowned for his uncompromising, devil-may-care town-taming skills from Texas clear up to Kansas. He'd more or less tamed Del Norte, though he considered it a work in progress. He booted the horse ahead along the trail, and a half hour later found himself riding into Bitterwater Canyon, a narrow cut with a dry arroyo wending its way along the trail's left side, choked with rocks and scrub brush. The trail curved to the right, and as the rock wall, spotted with hieroglyphics painted there long ago by the ancients, pulled back behind Mannion, the canyon opened before him. The old Scully Ranch cabin, a small, brush-roofed, age-silvered log affair, squatted ahead on the far side of the arroyo that cut across the trail 50 yards beyond. A small log stable and a connecting pole corral lay to the left of the shack. A good dozen white-faced beeves milled in the corral, half of them lying down, switching their tails at flies. Earl Drake's beeves long looped off his red feather range. Mannion would send for the rancher's riders when he'd cleaned up here. To the right of the shack leaned a privy of vertical pine planks, and with a gray wooden door adorned with the traditional half-moon. A blonde-haired woman in a sack dress was pulling a bucket of water up out of the well. Hearing the slow thudding of Red's hooves as Mannion put the horse across the wooden bridge that spanned the arroyo, she turned her head toward the newcomer. The woman. Yeah, Mannion had heard that Colvin had a woman. A former whore and dance hall girl went the rumor. She didn't look half bad, either. Not the kind of woman you'd expect to ride with Colvin. Not young, but not old, either. Mannion saw as Red clomped off the bridge and into the yard fronting the place. Just tired-looking, with large brown eyes that held little interest in the newcomer, or maybe in much else in her hard, worn-out life. A life that had come to this. Running with a lowly, long-looping, back-shooting dog like Frank Colvin and his brothers. It had likely either been that or growing fat and dead too soon as a percentage gal. Damn the poor gal's rotten luck. Mannion drew rein a good 20 feet from the woman standing by the well, holding the bucket as she stared blandly at him. The breeze touching the thick, curly blonde hair that hung to her shoulders, and which the lens clear mountain sun limned with a salmon sheen. She had an age-lined but delicately featured face with a wide, full mouth, though the lips were badly scammed. They shone with dried blood. One eye still shone with the remnants of a bruise. Those large, flat, lusterless eyes were damn haunting. Mannion unsnapped the keeper thongs from over the hammers of his Russians. "Frank here," he called to the woman. She didn't say anything. She just stared at Mannion for a few more seconds before turning and walking with no urgency toward the cabin. She mounted the small wooden stoop fronting it, glanced once more over her shoulder at Mannion, then opened the door, stepped inside, and pulled the door closed behind her. Mannion heard her muffled voice on the other side of the door. Boots thudded, and then the door opened again. Frank Colvin stepped out onto the stoop. He was a short, broad-shouldered man with thick, curly brown hair and a thick, curly brown beard carpeting his round, fleshy face. Some said the Colvins had some Mexican blood, and it shone in Frank's complexion and brown eyes. He was dressed only in wash-worn red long-handles and boots. He wore two pistols in holsters thonged low on his thighs. A wooden scraping sound and the squawk of leather hinges rose on Mannion's left. He swung his head in that direction to see Frank's bear-like brother James, JJ for short, step out of the stable and into the yard, cradling an old model Schofield revolver in the crook of each crossed arm. A floppy-brimmed hat shaded his beard, Bruin-like face, in which two small eyes were set, gray as dead coals. Another scraping rose on Mannion's right. He turned to see yet another Colvin brother, Grayson, step out of the privy. Grayson was tall and lean, with curly dark brown hair like Frank's, but with an oddly feminine-looking face. Grayson wore a checked shirt, tails out, pocket torn, and buckskin trousers. A battered funnel-brimmed Stetson sat on his head. He spat to one side as he rested the Spencer repeating rifle on his right shoulder and grinned. Footsteps sounded ahead of Mannion. He turned his head forward to see the fourth Colvin brother walk up along the right side of the cabin. Lute Colvin was built like Frank, only broader and with a big, bulging belly. His brown beard was liberally stitched with gray. He wore a black hat, buckskin tunic, baggy sack trousers, and knee-high Apache-style moccasins. He had two guns strapped to his broad hips and held an old Spencer repeater in both hands up high across his chest. He stopped at the corner of the cabin and stared without expression at the newcomer, his flat brown eyes none so vaguely threatening. "Well, well, well, brothers," Frank said, grinning at Mannion and unsnapping the keeper thongs from over both of his holstered Remingtons. "Look who's here. Bloody Joe his own self. Come to die, did you, Joe?" Chapter 2 You alone, Mannion? James Colvin called from the privy, the breeze slowly opening and closing the privy door behind him. Nah, I got the cavalry from Fort Winslow out here, Mannion said. We got the place surrounded. You best throw down those irons and come peaceful-like, or get shot to ribbons standing right there. Frank grinned as he kept his gaze on Mannion. Mannion always comes alone. Don't you, Mannion? Mannion sighed as he swung down from the leather. He slapped Red's rump. The bay galloped to the edge of the yard, then stopped and swung back around as though to watch the upcoming festivities. That's about the size of it. Still, toss down those irons or I'll shoot you to ribbon standing right there. Feel you so full of lead you'll rattle when you walk. There's four of us, Mannion, the bear-like Lute said. The breeze grabbed tufts of his thick tumbleweed hair hanging down his thick shoulders, the sun glowing red in it. He jutted his square jaw at the lawman and pinched up his eyes. And Frank's fast, faster than you. That right, Frank, Mannion said. You faster than me, Frank. Sure as hell I am, Frank said, smiling, holding his hands over the grips of his pistols. I've been practicing. Besides, they say you've slowed down over the years. You might have once been fast. Oh, you was fast when you first came to Del Norte. There's no denying that, but I heard Everett Dix beat you at the draw last year out behind the three-legged dog in Sapanero. His grin broadened, eyes flashing boldly. Mannion inwardly winced. The man was right. He'd been beaten at the draw the previous summer. Dix had triggered his Colt an eye wink faster than Mannion had triggered his Russian. Dix had dropped the shot, though, and took Mannion in the left leg, laying him up for a good 6 weeks. Going down, Mannion had snuffed Dix's wick with a lung shot. It had taken Dix 2 days to die, but he'd died all right. Still, the damage had been done. Bloody Joe was no longer as fast as he once had been. That had, unfortunately, emboldened his enemies, just as it had emboldened the Colvins standing before and to both sides of him now. Mannion had to admit a twinge of apprehension. Might have been foolhardy riding in here like this with no one to back his play. He probably should have waited till good dark and then kicked in the door. The trouble was in his mind, if not in his body. He was still the same lightning-fast town tamer who'd gotten Del Norte under rein 5 years ago. Banji. He couldn't help thinking of her now. He never used to do that, worry about leaving her. He'd been that good. Maybe, like everyone else around him now seemed to think, he no longer was. Or had Dix been a fluke? He was about to find out. Frank kept grinning at him. The breeze moaned around the yard, lifting dust. Birds piped in the pines. Then, suddenly, eerily, they grew silent. And the yard became as quiet as a church on a Saturday night. Straight out away from Mannion, Frank Colvin's hands dropped in a blur of quick motion. His grin broadened and his eyes intensified as he raised both hog legs. Boom, boom! It was Mannion's twin Russians that spoke first, both bullets punching into Frank's chest and blowing him straight back into the cabin with a look of startled horror on his fat, fleshy face. The woman's scream was muffled by a blast from Mannion's right-hand Russian just as the fat Colvin brother Lute raised his Spencer and gritted his teeth. The rifle roared as Lute, jouncing backward with Mannion's bullet in his belly, blew up a fist-sized chunk of ground 6 feet in front of him. Mannion dropped to a knee as to his left, as Grayson's Winchester carbine lapped flames, sending lead caroming through the air where the lawman's head had been a second before. The whip-cracking report was followed by the pop of one of James's Schofields, the echo of which hadn't died before the Russians bucked and roared twice more, quickly. James cursed as he twisted around and flew back against the stable, and Grayson screamed and tossed his Winchester high in the air and flew straight back into the privy. He took a seat over the hole and canted his head to one side, as though deeply tired. Clicking the hammers of both hog legs back, Mannion swung around quickly toward the stable, then eased the tension in both trigger fingers when he saw James kneeling over a water trough as though in prayer at an altar, arms hanging straight down against his sides, unmoving. His face was in the water. The lawman tightened his fingers over the Russian's triggers again when he spied movement in the corner of his left eye. He jerked around, spying a Winchester carbine aimed at him from just inside the cabin door. At first, he thought it must be Frank, but too late he saw the twin blue eyes of the woman gazing down the barrel at him, saw her blonde hair fluttering against her pale, drawn cheeks. Too late he saw the mildness of those eyes, the lack of killing intent, because by then he'd pulled the triggers of both Russians. They bucked and roared once more, punching two 44 caliber rounds into the woman's cream shirt waist, making it buffet against her chest. She screamed as she stumbled backward, dropping the carbine onto the stoop. She stopped, getting her feet set beneath her. She glanced down at the twin holes in her chest, red stains growing over each breast. She lifted her head and gazed with a peculiar concentration at the lawman who'd killed her. She took one uncertain step forward, then dropped to her knees with a sharp, "Oh!" hair bouncing on her shoulders. Her gaze still held Mannion's. Her lids closed over her eyes, and she fell straight down onto the stoop without breaking her fall. She lay there, belly down, arms stretched out above her head. Mannion gazed at the woman in shock, heart hammering his breastbone, smoke curling from the barrel of each hog leg still aimed straight out before him. Slowly, he lowered the irons to his sides and cursed. "Now, while in the hell," he said under his breath, "did you do that?" Those eyes, Mannion thought as he rode through a broad valley with misty blue-green pine-carpeted ridges rising on both sides of him, the woman's blanket-wrapped body tied over the back of the horse he trailed behind him by its bridle reins. It was one of the Colvin gang's mounts he'd found in the stable. Those eyes. Those damn eyes. He kept seeing them as he rode. Shadows stretching out from the southern ridge on his right as he walked the horses south toward Del Norte, which lay on the other end of the valley between the San Juan Range to the south and the Sawatch Range to the north. Behind him now. He kept blinking his own eyes in a futile attempt to rid them of the haunting image of the woman's sad, desperate blue orbs as they'd stared down the barrel of the Winchester at him, waiting for him to kill her. That's what she'd done. She'd made him kill her. Yeah. Sad, desperate eyes. But there'd been a vague cunning in them, too. She'd known he'd have no choice but to shoot, and thus killing her put her out of her mental misery, but also leaving him baffled and haunted. Those eyes had looked just like Sarah's eyes in her last desperate days. Weary, exhausted, troubled beyond the human will to endure. It was almost as though Sarah had returned from the dead to kill herself before him once more. Only, this time he'd killed her. She tricked him into killing her, honing his guilt for having been unable to help her to a fine edge. "Why, lady?" he said.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?